Hey Amarillo, I'm Jason Boyette, and you're listening to Hey Amarillo, the interview podcast featuring some of the most interesting people and stories of Amarillo, Texas. This episode is supported by Dr. Eddie Sauer, who practices general dentistry at Shimon Dental Group. Dr. Sauer has been my dentist ever since I was in college. He's taken care of my kids' teeth ever since they had their teeth show up. He is a national speaker on Invisalign and uses that technology to improve his patients' smiles and positioning. We've used it in our family. We've had great results. We liked it so much better than metal braces, which I had when I was a kid, and it wasn't fun. Invisalign is really, really great. Learn more by following Shimon Dental on Facebook or visit shimondental.com. That's S-H-E-M-E-N. And as part of this podcast partnership with Brick & Elm Magazine, I want to give a podcast shout out to realtor Tia Van Rijn of Legends Realty Group and to Reform Physical Therapy, Pilates, and Aesthetics. Read the free e-edition of Brick & Elm's current March-April 2024 issue at brickandelm.com. Okay, so this is sort of a special episode because it's an interview with my younger sister, Micah Boyette. Micah grew up here in Amarillo. She doesn't live here anymore. So I've been holding off on interviewing her until the right time came along. And this is the right time because she's a writer and she has a new book releasing this month called Blessed Are the Rest of Us, How Limits and Longing Make Us Whole. Now, if you know our family, you know that Micah's youngest son and my nephew, Ace, has Down syndrome. And Micah's a really talented writer about spirituality, and some of the challenges related to raising Ace led her into the ancient Christian teachings of the Beatitudes, and that's what this book is about. This book is about how those two things intermingle in her life. I've read it. It's really, really good. Micah is also a podcaster. She's the co-host of the very popular podcast, The Lucky Few, which celebrates people with Down syndrome. She's also the creator and host of her own podcast, The Slow Way. And despite living in New Jersey, Micah is still very closely tied to Amarillo. And we'll be back here in just a few weeks as part of her book tour. And so here's our conversation about her life and her book. Here's Micah Boyette. Micah Boyette, welcome to the Hey Amarillo podcast. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Jason. I'm honored to be here. I am the president of the Jason Boyette Fan Club of Northern New Jersey. I have been long-time listener of Hey Amarillo.
Well, good.
Long-time reader of Brick & Elm.
I've been meaning to shout out that fan club for years now, and finally we get the chance.
Finally.
So I'm going to acknowledge that I know some of the answers, but I'm going to start with you the same way I start with all my guests, and that's to ask you how you ended up in Amarillo in the first place.
All right. I was born in the old Northwest Texas Hospital in 1979. So 5 years after Jason was born, and we were born into the same family with the same parents. Okay. Because we're brother and sister.
Yeah, let's acknowledge that at the beginning. Which will make this a little bit of a different episode, but I do want to talk to you. We are doing this remotely instead of face-to-face, like most of my interviews do. Hopefully it still goes pretty well. And the reason I'm talking to you at this moment is because you have a book coming out, and I was waiting to do the Micah Boyette interview for this book, and you know, it just took you a few years to write it.
Took me a while.
But now we're here. And so I do want to talk about that in a little bit, but before we get to that point, just for people who don't know you and don't know about your connection to Amarillo, I want to cover some of that, some of those details. So we both went to Tascosa High School. You graduated from Tascosa. Tell me and listeners what happened after that point.
Tascosa, I went to Abilene for college. I went to Hardin-Simmons University. And Jason, you and I have talked about this. I was kind of the classic little sister who kind of just did what I wanted, even though for you it was sort of like, in our family, the responsible thing to do was stay in Amarillo and go to Amarillo College. And Jason followed the responsible path. Somehow I ended up convincing our parents that I could go away. I think it's just because they had a special place in their heart for me.
I think that's true.
Maybe so. And so to me, like going to the big school was going to Hardin-Simmons, Southern Baptist College. I had friends who were there, and it was really a great spot for me to go off to school and be in like this safe, gentle kind of setting.
You ended up being the queen of Hardin-Simmons. That's what we jokingly call you. But tell me what your plans were at that point. Like, did you have an idea of who you wanted to be or what you wanted to do other than, going to that campus?
Yeah, I did. I was always a very spiritual kind of kid, like just in weird ways. Well, mostly in weird ways. But we grew up in the Southern Baptist Church. I felt a deep connection to God from like my earliest memories. I have lots of strange mystical childhood experiences. And I think that to me, I like the dream of my life would have been for someone to step in and be like, "You, Micah Boyette, should be a pastor." And I was in a Southern Baptist church and no one stepped in and said that to me. And the closest thing that I had was these heroes in the Southern Baptist church of Lottie Moon and Annie Armstrong, who were missionaries. And there was sort of this like shortcut to being a female and being in ministry. If you could do all the things a pastor could do if you were female and you went to another country. And so that sort of felt, I mean, I don't think that most people would say that in the Southern Baptist Church, but that's kind of what it felt like to me. Mm-hmm. And I had this sense that I wanted to be in ministry and this was the way that I was going to do it. And so I started thinking and praying about that like since I was 10 years old. And in my head, the greatest thing I could do was never get married and go to the continent of Africa. I didn't have any specific place in mind. I just was going to like go live an adventurous life of being in some sort of ministry. I think that was like as much as my understanding of it went. And I just knew that I wanted my life to be like deeply meaningful. And so when I went to Hardin-Simmons, I went as a Bible major. And quickly, I found myself overwhelmed by that. And also, I think as a young woman in that space that was mostly guys, I felt pretty intimidated and changed my major pretty quickly to English literature. And that
which is
was
a very Boyette pursuit. I had already laid that path for you.
Jason laid a lot of paths for me, and I just happily stepped right into them. Jason had already gotten his English degree. When I was 16, I asked Jason for my birthday to paint a mural on my bedroom wall with quotes from John Keats and Walt Whitman. And goodness gracious, he did it.
It's
still there. It's still there with all my quotes. And yeah, I always had a love for writing and for reading. And you were an example to me that was a possibility. I think in my mind, I thought of people who were literary as kind of beyond my intellectual ability. And I really looked up to you that was something you had done. And I think it took me a while to make that my major because I wasn't sure if I had it in me. But I'm really grateful that I did.
I always tell people that you are the best writer in the family. You're definitely the most educated writer in the family. You know, I write for other people and I write some books, but you're a legit poet. And not just a poet who writes really good poetry, but someone who's actually been educated in that field. And so tell me about your path going from Hardin-Simmons, a small private Southern Baptist school to getting an MFA in poetry from Syracuse, which is not a well-trodden path, I would presume, especially not for boyettes.
Not for boyettes.
You left Texas to go to the Northeast to study poetry.
Yeah, I did. And thank you for saying that, Jason. You're always super generous about my writing, and it means a lot. In my English degree, I had to take either advanced grammar or creative writing. And I chose creative writing and ended up connecting with a professor at Hardin-Simmons who is a poet. And he was just really generous with me and encouraging of what I was doing. And I started working with him. I took several classes and then did like an individual study with him while I was in undergrad. And then I stayed in Abilene for an extra year working and continued to meet with him, like putting a manuscript together essentially of poetry. And he was always pushing me to get my master's. And I still was sort of this mindset that I would go off into the world and do ministry in some way. And poor Dr. Fink, I would say things like, you know, I just want to do something meaningful when he would tell me to study poetry. Oh, sorry, Dr. Fink. And finally I said, okay, I know you want me to do this. I will apply to one school. And I knew that Syracuse was a program that everyone had accepted, and it just accepted a few people, was a full ride. And I didn't have the money to go to grad school, and I didn't want to go into debt. So I applied to one MFA program. And lo and behold, I got in, even with my GRE scores, which I took after nose surgery, and I did terrible. I called you after crying.
Syracuse was a legit place, too. I mean, you studied with George Saunders, who has an Amarillo connection, Mary Carr. Mm-hmm. Tell me about, I don't want to give your entire, you know, life history. We don't have time for that. But I want to talk about what it was like for you to leave Texas, to leave a place where you were very comfortable, to go into a culture academically, socially, that was so different from how you had grown up.
Yeah. It was really terrifying. I definitely felt like the least educated person in the room. And, you know, I was surrounded by all these bohemian writers smoking their cigarettes, and I was just like this sweet thing from Amarillo, Texas. And I think because I was so committed to my Christian faith that I definitely was just weird. You know, I was very different than what the other people in my program were used to. And I think it says a lot about the people I studied with that I was welcomed and people were curious about me, and I made some really wonderful friendships. I also really needed the care of the professors that I had in just kind of navigating that world. Mary Carr, who's a poet and a memoirist, grew up in Texas, and she and I certainly didn't have the same kind of childhood, but she had a tender spot for me. And kind of my naivete, like, she just kind of looked out for me. And she mentioned to me once, you know, my first year in grad school, every time somebody name dropped a poet or fiction writer, I just wrote their name down secretly and looked it up later. And I was like, okay, thanks for the tip. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did. I was constantly writing down these people I've never heard of and then doing my homework at home. And one time, Mary, who had gone from having like a pretty secular, agnostic view of the world into Catholic faith, she had a really interesting story. And she looked out for me in that way, too, where I was trying to find a way into writing what I cared about, but not knowing how to do that in a way that was not saccharine and cheesy. And she sat down with me and we had long talks about what it looks like to write about faith in a way that's authentic, a way that is not shutting anybody out. Whatever you believe, like, there's space for you to walk into that and experience it with the writer. And, you know, she was like, you can't write about faith without writing about doubt. And if you're not willing to be honest about doubt, then your writing about faith will never be honest. And that was really powerful for me to start exploring and finding the people who the greats and the modern day writers who were writing about their faith in a way that was profound and inclusive and inviting.
Do you remember a point where you started to let go of that dream of mission work in Africa or wherever that might have been and embraced the fact that you could find fulfillment as a writer, whether that was poetry, whether it was writing about faith? Like was there a moment where you started to think, oh, okay, this is the path I'm going down?
Yeah, I think there was. I mean, I think there were several moments along the way. The first one was getting accepted to Syracuse and deciding that that was what I was going to do. And just this sense of like, how do I turn away this opportunity? And then, you know, I ended up meeting a guy while I was in Syracuse, even though Meemaw told me, don't you dare go up there and marry a Yankee. I did. That's our grandmother.
Who has always obeyed.
Except
for this one time by Micah.
And so I think after I met Chris and we were serious and I was like seeing that this writing thing was not just like a thing I tried in college, that it could be part of my life. I think I started to wrestle with like, why was this the story I had that I was going to go away? And I think some of that was, for lack of a better term, like a white savior complex of needing to feel like I could do something significant and save the world somehow. And I think also, just to get, deeply psychological here, I think that I had a lot of guilt about leaving our family and leaving Amarillo. I mean, I think one of the amazing things about Amarillo is that it's a place where people don't often leave still. It's a place that is, there's a lot of loyalty, and rightfully so. It's a beautiful place to live with beautiful people. And I didn't want to feel like I was not loyal or like I was choosing someplace else over my home or over my family. And I think the idea, like, if I went to across the world to do some, amazing thing with my life, then that would be okay for leaving my family. But
New Jersey. New Jersey is just
New Jersey. Marrying some guy from the suburbs of Philadelphia, like, maybe not as meaningful. So I had to work through that, and it took me a long time.
One of the things I want to talk about, and I don't need you to, I'll just give a brief synopsis of your life so that listeners know. You got married, you had kids, you lived in San Francisco for quite a while. In fact, you talked to me during my COVID chronicles over the phone about living in San Francisco in the very early days of the pandemic. You lived there for a while, and then during the pandemic, you moved to New Jersey. And so you have lived on both coasts. Mm-hmm. You have lived in very urban settings. You have recently written your second book. You also host a podcast. And so I want to talk about kind of the direction that your career has gone and what has influenced that. And if you want to kind of give listeners an idea of what you write, what you podcast about, what you're doing right now.
Okay, I'll start with what I write. I wrote a book in 2014. It was published, so exactly 10 years ago. And it was a book, as a spiritual nonfiction book, about motherhood and prayer, the spiritual life.
Not poetry.
Not poetry. And
in case anybody's afraid of that.
And it was, at that time in my life, I was writing a lot about parenting, and I was the mom of two young boys, and I was really working through my faith and what I believed. A lot was changing in what I believed, and I found a lot of direction for my faith in the ancient spiritual writers. So one of the things that I came to was Saint Benedict, who started the monastic, really started the whole monastic tradition back in, gosh, I should know this, 400 something. But as I studied about Saint Benedict and what the monastic tradition looked like, I was finding myself more and more in a space of needing that kind of container for my faith. To think of my back then daily time with my kids when I was home with them most of the time in that season as having meaning around it in terms of my spiritual life and not just being just the monotony of daily life, which it can feel like when you have little kids. So that book was me going deep into some ancient spiritual practices, and that has continued for me. I really find a lot of direction for my faith through the ancient mystics and saints and the writings from, you know, the people living in caves 1,000 years ago.
Which is not a particularly Southern Baptist way of pursuing your faith, we should say.
No, it's not.
It's been some change.
There's been some change. And that, yeah, I think that I really needed some rootiness to my faith. For me to hold on to it, I need to cling to the history and what people did in the past. And I find a lot of hope in the tradition. Yeah.
So your first book was about motherhood.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess the way you approached motherhood had to change when Ace was born. And
yeah.
People who know me will know about Ace. You know, our family talks about him more than anybody else in our family because he's the most important one in our family.
Mm.
Definitely the most beloved member of the Boyett family. But not just your life and your family changed when Ace was born, but really the direction your professional life went, whether it's through the podcasting, whether it's through the thinking about the book that's releasing now. And so tell us about Ace and about some of the things that had to shift with his birth.
Yeah. Ace is turning 9 soon, or maybe when this episode drops, it'll be around his birthday. Ace was diagnosed with Down syndrome in utero. So I found out at about 4 or 5 months that I was going to be having a baby with Down syndrome. And yeah, I think Ace changed the direction of a lot for me. And I think the reason that Ace changed the direction of my writing in particular is because I write to make sense of the world. And when Ace was born, I think there were just a lot of questions that I hadn't been forced to answer for myself until I had this little baby whose life I was in charge of, who I loved deeply, and who I was really afraid for. That I think I say this in the book, but a couple of weeks after he was born, I was dropping my oldest son off at school, and this casual acquaintance was, you know, our boys were running next to each other and going to line up in their line for school. And he said to me, "Congratulations on the baby." And I said, "Thanks." And he said, "How did you decide to keep it?" And I was just completely shocked to be asked that question. And for it to come out so casually of how did I decide to keep my child? And I think that was the first realization of this is a world that doesn't really want my son. This is a world that thinks it's interesting that he exists and that I allowed him to exist. And I had a lot of fears before Ace came in the world in those few months before he was born. You know, they were like, you know, how's this going to affect his brothers' lives? You know, what are they going to feel if somebody's making fun of him? Will we be able to give him what he needs? Like, what if he has a heart condition? There were all those feelings. Then he came into the world and I was like, oh, it's you. I know you. And he wasn't this diagnosis anymore. He was real. And then my fear turned to the outside world because I realized to everybody else, he was still a diagnosis. And many people see his existence and the existence of people, especially with intellectual disabilities, as burdens on society, burdens in our school systems. And those who would never say that or even admit to themselves that they feel that way still carry a lot of ableist just ways of viewing the world and ways of viewing value. And so I kind of moved from that moment of, wow, what does the world believe about my son? To what do I believe about my son? And I had to start answering questions for myself, like, what is it that makes us human? And what is it that gives us value? And who are we if we are not deemed valuable enough to the world because we can't accomplish what other people are accomplishing? And I think for me, that had to transform how I saw myself as well, because I had always valued myself by what I could do, by what I could accomplish, by how I appeared to the world, by whether or not I was good, whether that was like what if I was good to the grown-ups or if I was good to the people in my life or if I was good enough to God. And suddenly I had this like living, breathing human in my life who was telling me a totally different narrative about what makes us matter and what gives us meaning.
I want to tie back to your upbringing in Amarillo and how that impacted let's say your readiness to be the mom of a child with Down syndrome, also with autism, you know, which was a dual diagnosis that you learned a few years ago. But we were not unfamiliar as a family with people who had special needs. And I want to let you talk a little bit about how your childhood sort of shaped that that awareness, that preparation for it, I guess.
Yeah, it did. And it's funny because I remember thinking when I had my my ultrasound and they saw there was one marker of Down syndrome. And any woman out there who has been pregnant or known people who are pregnant, there is a lot of people who are told they have a marker for Down syndrome. It's very common. And then you do a blood test, and then in every case of every other person I knew, then you find out that your child does not have Down syndrome. And so I remember thinking, I took this blood test. I was like, there's no way I'm going to have a kid with Down syndrome because I have been around people with Down syndrome too much in my life. Like it's like
It feels too neat of a story.
It's too neat. Yeah. It's too easy. And yeah, we grew up, well, Jason And my mom spent, 40 years in deaf education, mostly in Amarillo, where she worked with really every hard of hearing or deaf child in the panhandle has gone through my mom's classroom until she retired a few years ago. And in that world, there are plenty of kids who were in her class with who were maybe hard of hearing, who also had other needs. And so I remember just getting to keep up with the kids, especially every once in a while, she would have a child with Down syndrome in her classroom, and they were always her favorite. I remember, like, she had one little boy's picture on her fridge. That's probably against the law now to have for a teacher to take home pictures of their students. So I had like that vision. Our mom also had volunteered in, there was a ministry at our church when we were younger. That was for people, mostly for people with intellectual disabilities. And my mom played piano for them sometimes on Sunday mornings. And
we sat with them on Sunday mornings when we went to church. Our family did.
Yeah, we did.
We were surrounded by that class.
Yeah, we were.
And some of them held our dad's hand.
Yeah. Everybody always during had a the crush church on service. Our dad.
Yeah.
And yeah, there was, I mean, that is a gift that our parents gave us, was just there was never any fear around people with any kind of intellectual disability. And we were given the opportunity to be in orbit around people who were different than us. And that was a beautiful thing. And then on top of that, I had a neighbor named Carrie who lived across the street. And she was in my grade, and so was my friend Malin. And there was the three of us in the neighborhood who just played together. We just played together a lot. And Carrie's parents were incredible at including her in our lives. And I think about this now because I know that the Americans with Disabilities Act wasn't passed until 1973. And Carrie was born in 78. And before that, it was most common for children to be institutionalized when they were born with something like Down syndrome. And Carrie's parents were just trailblazers. Her mom, Carol Ann, still lives across the street from my mom. And she is the best. She's no nonsense. And she was just like, yes, Carrie's going to be at Paramount Terrace School. Yes, she's doing brownies. Yes, she's playing volleyball and softball. And so Carrie was on every team of mine. We spent a lot of time together. And I have I forgot to mention earlier, I do this podcast that is a Down syndrome advocacy podcast. And one of my first episodes was me interviewing Malin, the other friend who lived down the road from me, because Carrie passed away maybe like 10 or 12 years ago now. I can't believe it's been that long. And Malin and I sat down and talked about our relationship with Carrie and how much it affected our lives. And Malin invited Carrie to live with her after college. And they lived together for several years until Carrie was ready to live on her own. And then she lived on her own, which is incredible. But yeah, I think about the way that relationship with Carrie transformed my life and gave me this view of people with Down syndrome in particular that was just like wide open and generous, and just the ability to grow up seeing her value, so that when Ace showed up in my life, I had all this experience already. That's incredible.
So your first book was about parenting, and it was tied into Saint Benedict and those ancient voices. Your second book is about parenting, tied into the Beatitudes, but it's mostly about Ace and how Ace shifted the personal values you have, the values of your family, the way you look at the world, and the way that you look at the way he interacts with the world. And so I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about Blessed Are the Rest of Us and sort of the mindset that went into writing that book and what you hope for it to accomplish?
I started writing about Ace early after he was born, just wanting to, there were just these moments with him that felt, you know, whatever word you want to use, magical, mystical, the sense of him being closer to the kind of pureness of heart that I wanted to have, that I want to have. And as I wrote these stories, I think I just kept coming back to this thing I was talking about before. Like, why doesn't the world see his value? And what does it mean to have value? And maybe the way that the world tells us we're valuable is not trustworthy. And the teaching of Jesus that I kept coming back to is the Beatitudes, because I think it's remarkable. I think it's an incredible passage. And I have always been a little bit unsure about it, too. I've never been a big fan of the word blessed and or blessing, especially as it's used in our hashtag social media world. I've always had, at least since my 20s, I've had a problem with people claiming that they're blessed because they got a parking spot, or people claiming that they're blessed because their kids made straight A's, or because they got to go to Hawaii. And I guess the reason that I have a problem with that is that I see the people in the world who are struggling the most. And I see the things that Jesus has to say about who is most important. And I can't see that that the people who are hungry are not blessed when Jesus, in the things that he had to say about who is most important, was always saying that the hungry and the poor and the powerless and the ones who are working to bring justice on this earth, that they are the ones who should get the blessing. So I started to think about how do I define blessing? What does that mean to me? And why is it that Jesus is calling those things, like in the Beatitudes, he's listing the people who get to have the blessing. And the people who get to have the blessing are the ones who everybody else says, well, you're definitely not blessed. Like, you're the one who's grieving. You're the one who is, you know, being persecuted for doing what's right in the world. And I also, okay, so I had this problem. I just have a problem with when people tell me that Ace is a blessing. Maybe that sounds unfair, but I was immediately sent all the time from people after he was born, memes and stories and thoughts that he was going to be the greatest blessing of all, and that he was really an angel sent from heaven to make our lives happy. These kinds of things. And I started to feel like there was this opposite, these two dichotomies going on. There was like either Ace is a burden, and a lot of people see him that way as a drain on resources, or Ace is an angel, and he's here to make everybody feel better. And both things are not true, because both things take away his humanity. Ace is a human, and he has so much to offer the world, not because he's an angel, but because he's a person. And so I'm putting all these things together, and I'm kind of going in a circle here, Jason, but stick with me.
I'll let you do it.
As I started to research the Beatitudes, I learned that maybe the English translation of the word that Jesus uses when he recites, he recites this poem. I think of it as a poem at the beginning of his Sermon on the Mount, the longest recorded sermon that he gives. And he's using this word, makarios. And that word is not necessarily translated blessed as you translate it in the English. And it was an oratory device that the Greco-Roman thinkers and speakers would use in that day about like how to have true happiness, how to live a flourishing and whole life. And so they would stand up and say, like, whole or flourishing are you? And then they would list, if you are honest, you know, if you work hard. So they would lay down these virtues that a good person should do. And those are the people who are going to flourish in this life. And Jesus takes that speaking device and he stands up at the beginning of his longest sermon and he says, let me tell you about what it means to have a whole and flourishing life. You are moving towards wholeness and flourishing when you are poor or poor in spirit. You're moving towards wholeness or flourishing when you are weak or giving up your power. You're moving towards it when you're grieving. And so he starts listing these things that are the worst things, the things that we all spend our lives avoiding. And I started to realize, okay, maybe I've had this wrong view of what blessing is. Like, I've thought about it the way that everybody uses it. Like, God blesses these people who have it easy over here. But God doesn't bless these people who are suffering over here. And really what Jesus is talking about is wholeness. And that's what I was so curious to learn about, to lean into, to think about in terms of Ace's life. Because Jesus in that poem is saying, you are whole as you grieve, as you release your power, as you move towards peacemaking and justice in the world. And that sounds really beautiful to me and so much richer and fuller than this idea of like, God gives some people good things and some people bad things and hope you're the one who gets the good thing.
I want to talk about, to kind of close up this section, about how your ties to Amarillo, whether it's the family, whether it's your upbringing, your, you know, two or three times a year visits back here, mm-hmm. how that continues to inform who you are and what you do and how you tell stories. I think every writer is really a storyteller. Every poet is a storyteller and Amarillo is still a big part of your story. So talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. There's a lot that shaped me. The foundation of my life is shaped being in Amarillo. I think it took me years of living far away, and I lived in some pretty hilly and tree-soaked places to not feel claustrophobic because I just need the wide open space. I need the like grassy plain and the big old sky and that sense of what beauty is and beauty with this this stark kind of beauty that comes from what's not there, that is deep in me. But I also think as I've lived in these places that are very urban, spent 12 years in San Francisco living in the city, raising my kids in the city, I think I have a real love and deep appreciation for the way people in Amarillo live and continue to live in a very communal-minded way. And that it's something that maybe is hard for Amarilloans to see, but there's the first time I brought my husband to Amarillo, I said, there's something about the way people live here that is just this simple way of being in the world, or like a slower way of being in the world that speaks to my soul and that I miss deeply. And I still miss it. I think about when our dad died and how many people showed up with casseroles who we barely knew. And maybe they barely knew Dad, I don't know, but there's just a generosity of spirit that is really profound and is not, it's not just a like aw shucks, there's nice people here, it is kind of in the water. That's shaped me a lot. And I think I am, even in the ways that I talk about, I write a lot about like what it means to live more slowly. I write a lot about rest. And I think a lot of the reasons I'm drawn to those things is because I grew up with that in my life.
Today's episode is supported by Pinnacle by Rockrose, a new master planned neighborhood being developed at Hollywood and Bell, south of Randall High School. It's located in the Canyon ISD and is the only neighborhood in Amarillo that contains schools from kindergarten all the way to 12th grade. So a kid can start their education at Sundown Lane Elementary, then go to Pinnacle Intermediate School, and then to Randall Junior High and Randall High School, and they're all within just a few blocks of each other. And as the neighborhood develops, it'll be full of open spaces and parkways, including a walkway that connects all of those schools within the neighborhood. I've seen these plans. I've seen some of the featured homes. It's a really exciting project by Rockrose Development. So to learn more, visit pinnaclebyrockrose.com. That's pinnaclebyrockrose.com. Okay, I'm back with Micah Boyette. Micah, this is the part of the show I call Eight Straight. I know you're familiar with it. Eight Straight is sponsored every week by Panhandle Plains Historical Museum in Canyon. It's the largest history museum in Texas, and this is one I chose, a fact I chose for you. Its collection includes dozens of quilts of various sizes made by Panhandle people. It really has a lot of quilts up there. I imagine our grandmother was a quilter, and she probably thinks that most of her quilts are museum quality and should be part of the museum's archives.
We should be donating them.
We should be. The museum would probably say no to that. But
and my cat just peed on one last week. Well,
definitely don't want that one. Don't tell Meemaw.
I know.
I hope she's not listening. You can learn more about Panhandle Plains at panhandleplains.org. Okay, so the first question, this is one I've been asking all my guests. I know that you are not a permanent resident, but you are familiar enough with Amarillo. I feel that you can answer some of these questions.
Okay.
When you think of Amarillo 10 years from now, what do you hope for?
Okay. Yeah, I have hopes for Amarillo. I really hope for a thriving downtown. I've been just delighted to watch how the downtown has changed and has grown, and the arts that have sprung up. I'm the biggest fan of the Hoodoo Mural Festival. And yeah, I want to see a thriving downtown. I hope that the community is supporting schools and students, that there's space for the arts and music to continue to grow. I also worry a lot about climate change, and I think a lot about the recent fires. I know I wasn't there for it, and it must have been pretty terrifying and heartbreaking. And I don't know. I hope that Amarillo can be a leader in wind energy, and that we can find ways to work to reverse the rise in natural disasters that's been happening. So that's a lot of answers.
No, that's good. Other than wind, what does this area have too much of?
Okay, this might be unpopular, especially as an outsider. I think we have too many parking lots. There's a lot of parking lots in Amarillo. I just love walkability, and I think that's one of the things that makes me most excited about downtown Amarillo, is the way that people are able to be together and engage in the space. And yeah, I think I love it when city planners are prioritizing the needs of humans over the ease of cars. So that's my...
I think that's one of those things that leaving the city, whether it's just to travel or whether you leave it temporarily or permanently, that it exposes you to other cultures, and especially cultures in which the car is not given priority. Mm. And so it takes visiting a place like New York City or places in Europe or San Francisco, mm-hmm. where you've lived, that where you see, oh, it's there's a different kind of life here, where you're not climbing in your car and driving and looking for parking lots all day long. That the being on your feet in a community helps you see the community in a different way, and that's why I think people who travel a lot learn to value walkability Whereas if you don't ever leave here, you don't ever think about that.
And, you know, I think about what a special place Amarillo is in terms of neighborliness and friendliness. And, man, I think if you could combine that with people just getting to be near each other all day and engaging with life and going to the store and walking to the park, all of those things, it would be a pretty incredible high-notch friendliness. People could be really happy.
High-notch friendliness is your suggested new slogan for the Convention and Visitors Bureau. Directly from a poet.
Yours. You can take it.
What does this area not have enough of?
Okay, I'm going to get spicy. Female pastors.
Okay.
Yeah. I think,
accurate.
You know,
that's true.
I could have long theological conversations with whoever wants, you know, about biblical texts and why Jesus empowered and empowers women to lead in the church. But I think my faith has survived and thrived because of the women pastors in my life. And I think that everyone's missing out when women aren't acknowledged as pastors and teachers, leaders in places of faith. So
I fully agree with that. To be fair, that's not just an Amarillo problem. It's a problem of conservative evangelical Protestantism.
Yes.
Or Catholicism. A lot of long and deep traditions have struggled with that. And maybe you're starting to see some progress, but it's still way too late, I believe. There's a lot of catching up to do. What's your favorite local coffee shop?
Palace all the way. Fan of Palace. I have my Palace app and everything just for when I come. But sometimes I don't use my points quick enough because I don't come back in town in time and they go away. That's my one complaint today.
that you're not visiting enough or that they're not letting you hold on to your points
both
long
things.
Enough.
No, but I do love Palace. I'm
okay,
a big fan.
What's your favorite local restaurant or food truck?
Okay, so many great places and so many that, some cool stuff that has opened up in the last few years that you've taken me to, Jason. But I think I always come back to my favorite breakfast is Huevos Rancheros at La Frontera. And no matter where I go or live in this world, that will be my favorite breakfast.
Okay, I think a lot of people would agree with that. What's the most underrated thing about Amarillo?
Outside of Amarillo, I would say people don't really understand how great a sunset can be. There's just nothing like sunset in the Panhandle. Or outside of Amarillo, I think too that like Palo Canyon doesn't get enough credit. I wish that more people knew about Palo Canyon. But then there's also just like the culture of Amarillo, like I mentioned before, that I love how communities show up for each other in Amarillo. I think it's really special. And I think that people really know how to care for each other and how to be a good neighbor. And it's beautiful.
What's your favorite street in Amarillo?
Okay, I thought a lot about this. And I'm going to be a little cheesy, but I think Lynette Drive, where our house is, that we grew up in. A lot of good memories on Lynette.
No complaints about that. Our house was the first one on its block. It was mostly empty ranch land when Dad somehow decided that's where he was going to build his one and only house.
And the amount of baseball games in that tiny, tiny front yard, it's remarkable. There's a lot of games in that yard.
Yeah. Had we known that, maybe he would have made the yard bigger earlier. That would have helped.
Maybe.
Or not planted a couple of trees that we had to work around. But
he probably couldn't have been convinced. He had a
okay,
vision.
You mentioned Palo Duro Canyon. When was the last time you visited the canyon?
You know, I think it's been 5 or 6 years, so this is probably the longest stretch I've ever gone without going to the canyon. The last time I went, I took my two older boys and our niece to see Texas. But I did just tell a friend in San Francisco, a friend from San Francisco who's driving across the country this year. I was like, you've got to stop and hike at Palo Canyon. So I'm doing my part. I'm advocating.
Okay. All right. That concludes the 8 straight questions. I like to close by asking my guests to endorse something. So what's one thing you would like listeners to know about or to experience?
Again, I have a long list of things, but I won't endorse Brick and Elm because even though I think it's an incredible magazine, because, you know, I'm biased.
I hope they know already.
I also thought about endorsing Mission 2540, but I'm also biased about that. That's our other brother, Brooks, his amazing nonprofit. So I think I want to endorse the Panhandle Down Syndrome Guild, which is really doing beautiful things to support and give community to self-advocates living with Down syndrome and their families. And I just appreciate all of the work they do. My mom has gotten to be part of that, and our family takes part in the Buddy Walk every September. And I'm grateful they exist and for all the families that they're supporting.
Our mom is on the board, and we are big fans here of the work that they do, and try to stay involved with it. Even if you're not here or Ace is not here, we're still doing the Buddy Walk with, you know, photos and posters of Ace and shirts and stuff. He's been here for a few of them, but big fans of that organization.
Yeah. And Ace has an amazing fan club in you guys, which is a real gift for him.
Well, we love him too. Micah Boyette, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Jason. It was a joy.
And that concludes the episode. You can find out more about Micah and her books at micahboyette.com. I'm also putting a link to find the latest book, Blessed Are the Rest of Us, in the notes for this show. Additionally, Micah will be here in Amarillo on Sunday, May 5th, preaching at both services at St. Andrew's Episcopal Church. She's also leading a spiritual practices workshop during the Sunday school hour in between those. And there's also the possibility of her doing a special reading at Burrowing Owl that first weekend in May. It's not quite organized yet, but look for it. Keep a heads up if you're interested. And be sure to order Blessed Are the Rest of Us. It officially releases April 9th. About a week from now. Thanks to Pinnacle by Rockrose, Shimon Dental, and Panhandle Plains Historical Museum for sponsoring this podcast. Thanks also to Angelina Marie for editing the show. And thank you for listening. Hey Amarillo exists on a weekly basis because of listeners like you and the local people who support it financially through patreon.com/heyamarillo. Hey Amarillo's executive producers include Patrick Burns, Jason Burr, Katie Linger, Corey Burns, Wes Reeves, Josh Wood, Barbara and Jim Witten, and Cindy Graham. This has been episode 347. My name is Jason Boyette. I don't always interview members of my family, but I'll see you next week.